In the matter of comprehensive neurosurgical PC versus the Valley Hospital, can we please have appearances of counsel? Welcome, counsel. We're going to go to roughly 12:30. I imagine we'll get through Mr. Perino's argument. We'll see where things stand and then likely take a 30-minute break. Mr. Perino, please go ahead.
Chief Justice, if I could reserve a few minutes for rebuttal, I'd be grateful. In the healthcare area, our jurisprudence cautions against the second guessing of managerial decisions of a hospital. The reason for this is simple. Courts just aren't equipped to weigh the intrinsic complexities that hospitals confront every day in advancing patient care. So when a hospital's decision is reasonably related to a public health objective, that decision is accorded deference and should be allowed to stand. In the absence of such deference, hospitals will be deterred from making innovative policy decisions to improve healthcare for fear of facing ruinous lawsuits. I have three key points that I'll address, and I'll do my best to address them briefly and within 5 minutes. First, the contract claims in this case should have been dismissed on summary judgment based on the deferential standard I just mentioned. The trial court made a number of key findings on summary judgment that make this conclusion inescapable. The court found, quote, there's nothing in the record to support the notion that either the board or the hospital's president, Myers, made their decisions regarding the exclusivity agreement in an unreasonable manner. The court found that Valley, and not just the board or the board president, but Valley Hospital, quote, undertook a rational and routine course of action to further Valley's long-standing alignment strategy to improve patient care and economic efficiency. The court found that plaintiffs, quoting again, had no contractual entitlement, or expectation of ER calls at Valley. The court found that even if the plaintiffs held such expectations, those expectations would be unreasonable. Based on those findings, as we know, summary judgment was granted in favor of Valley's board and its president. But Valley is a corporate entity that can only act through the decisions of its officers and agents. The claims were dismissed against those officers and agents and should have been dismissed against Valley on summary judgment at the same time. Second point, with regard to the trial itself, the deceptive and misleading comments made by plaintiff's counsel in summation require reversal. After successfully keeping testimony from the jury that plaintiffs transferred 60 patients from Valley's ER to Hackensack, plaintiff's counsel told the jury that there was only evidence of two transfers, and that if additional evidence of transfers existed, it would have been presented by Valley's counsel. Plaintiff's counsel then went on to specifically and unequivocally declare, I'm quoting, there isn't any evidence of it at all. There isn't any evidence of it at all. Zealous advocacy is encouraged. Deceiving the jury is not. That was the holding in Garcia, a criminal case, and in Bender, a civil case. The court has put attorneys on notice that we cannot exploit trial court rulings that exclude evidence in an effort to deceive the jury. The misleading statements here went to the very heart of plaintiff's case and clearly had the capacity to cause an unjust result. Third and final point, the trial court allowed plaintiffs to exploit inadvertently disclosed privileged emails between Valley and its general counsel. Counsel was called to the stand in a highly improper attempt to embarrass and discredit her on the mistaken ground that Valley had placed its counsel advice an issue. But in-house counsel here did what all smart lawyers do in advising clients about potential litigation. She outlined a strategy which included the preparation of a written report. It's what we all do week after week. She didn't write the report. She didn't do an investigation. She didn't provide the data relied upon in the report. Valley was denied a fair trial because the emails were used unfairly to spin conspiracy theories and to poison the jury. If allowed to stand, the appellate division decision will chill the free flow of information between attorneys and their clients. We ask this court to do what should have been done on summary judgment, dismiss the remaining contract claims, or alternatively, grant a new trial because of counsel's improper summation and the erroneous disclosure and use of attorney-client emails. Glad to take your questions.
Ms. Perito, oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No.
Go ahead.
I had a couple of questions about questions 4 and 5 on the verdict sheet and also the summary judgment record. And for my questions, just assume for the sake of this discussion that the bylaws do not constitute a underlying contract on which an implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing could be based. We know in the amended complaint, plaintiffs allege that by virtue of the party's agreement and the obligations set forth in the bylaws, and we know the judge charged the jury separately on contract formation principles and the theory of the implied covenant claim. My question for you as to question number 4 on the verdict sheet, and question number 4 is, do you find by a preponderance of the evidence that the Valley Hospital Comprehensive Neurosurgical PC entered into a contract? The question is that, quote, contract, the bylaws, this separate agreement that Dr. Roth testified about during the trial, or a combination?
So we obviously don't know what was in the minds of the jurors. What we do know, what was pled in the amended complaint. What was pled in the amended complaint was a breach of contract action based on the bylaws and a breach of the implied covenant based arising out of the bylaws.
See, that was my question, because I'm looking at your supplemental brief on page 28, and specifically the quote to the amended, to the language in the amended complaint is, by virtue of the party's agreement and the obligation set forth in the bylaws, a special relationship existed whereby the hospital was obligated to deal fairly and honestly with respect to all matters pertaining to the bylaws. Is it a separate agreement or is it bylaws itself?
The matter that was pled in the amended complaint is the bylaws. That's the only agreement that's alleged, and it's the only agreement that's pled. There are allegations in the complaint about, you know, how the arrangement came to pass and atmospherics with respect to the back and forth that led to the plaintiffs coming to Valley. What happens next, as Your Honor knows, is there's a motion for summary judgment based on the pleadings that then existed, the deposition transcripts, the full record in the case, and the trial court makes the findings that I just referenced in my opening. Thereafter, at trial, but more frankly on appeal and by the trial court judge on the motion for judgment notwithstanding the verdict, there is this discussion about something beyond the bylaws. Those are the words that the trial judge uses. There's something beyond the bylaws. Again, wasn't pled, case really wasn't tried on that basis. But to that point, even assuming for a moment that the notion here was that there was, I guess, an oral agreement or a different additional agreement that was entered into, putting aside for the moment that these parties know how to enter into a contract, they know, and Dr. Roth from the plaintiffs did it at Hackensack when he signed up to earn an extra $250,000 a year, they know how to paper a contract. Putting that aside even, the plaintiffs are now saying that there was this agreement which effectively granted them forever privileges, just as they had back before this case came to pass. That position now and the difficulty with it and the point that we would be grateful if your honors would take into consideration is that that argument is frankly that that agreement that they would have forever privileges was breached when Valley took the steps it took to enter an exclusive arrangement with Columbia. That claim, that argument, is a breach of contract argument. It's not a breach of the implied covenant and good faith and fair dealing. It's a breach of what they claim in its express provision of the contract. And under Wade versus Kessler, it's not permitted. You can't have a breach of covenant, good faith and fair dealing claim that is a claim that alleges a breach of the term of the contract. So it's a long way of answering your question. I think that's how we got to this point. My suggestion to your honor is that the way it ends is with a finding that even if there was this amorphous arrangement beyond the bylaws, it's not an implied covenant claim. It's a breach of contract claim, and that claim was dismissed.
And that's not how the judge charged the jury correctly. To your point, I think there were two claims. Breach of contract, meaning they didn't get a hearing under the bylaws, and breach of an implied covenant, Wade, which dealt with something beyond the bylaws, which brings me to my second question, and that is the summary judgment record. I didn't see anything in the record that dealt with anything beyond the bylaws. Everything at the summary judgment record dealt with only the bylaws, I think. I'm not sure. Am I incorrect about that?
You are absolutely correct, Justice. That's the way this case was pled. And that's, as I said before, that's the way the case was really tried. And the reason for that, of course, is had they directly alleged this agreement beyond the bylaws, it would have been tacked in discovery. It would have been the subject of a motion for summary judgment, and it would have been dealt with, head on. Instead, we had sort of this, scope creep as it related to the way the case was ultimately presented and argued on appeal. So you're 100% correct, Your Honor.
If I remember correctly, the testimony that Dr. Roth gave in his deposition that has been referenced at the summary judgment stage, it's unlike his trial testimony in that at trial, he testified about this special arrangement, this agreement whereby he had been encouraged on behalf of the plaintiffs to join the medical staff and then take over and invest time and to build a practice of neurosurgery at Valley.
Yes, and never is there the direct contention that there was an agreement reached on this point. It was ours to lose. We came and did a lot in terms of getting the program up and running, and we expected, based on that fact, that we would have privileges forever. Based on the summary judgment record, we know what the court's view of those allegations were as they existed at the time summary judgment was decided. And we know from this court's opinions in Chiafalo, if that's how you say it, and Lombardo, the record to be considered here on this appeal with respect to this petition is the record that existed on summary judgment. And we know what those findings were. They're directly on point with respect to the question that that Your Honor is raising. There is no contractual entitlement or expectation of ER calls at Valley. Trial court made that specific finding and others.
I noticed that as to whether the bylaws of the medical staff constitute a contract or not, there's reference to the case of Joseph versus Passaic Hospital. But if correct me if I'm wrong, that case decided 64 years ago was not an implied covenant case. It was a consolidated Chancery and Law Division case, Law Division being conspiracy. And Chancery, all it did was remand for a hearing, which essentially is equitable relief when bylaws are breached. Is it your position that if a member of the medical staff of Valley contends that the rights under the bylaws have been breached, the proper remedy would be equity rather than money damages?
You're, of course, correct as it relates to the Joseph case. That's exactly what that case was about. The claim against the hospital was solely for equitable relief, and that was in the form of seeking a hearing when a hearing had not been provided. The relief here in this context, given what has happened years later in Desai and Berman, we know what the standard is now, and we know what standard should be applied. And the relief that should be sought in a case like this, and frankly was sought, which was the relief that the case was brought under and the applications were made in the Chancery Court, was for equitable relief, was for a hearing, and those claims, of course, were denied at that stage of the case.
Counsel, you began your presentation by saying one shouldn't second-guess managerial decisions. Those fall within the discretion of the hospital, alluding to the Berman case, of course. Does that presuppose the existence of good faith? Take this case, for example, and assume for this question only what you oppose, and that is that the hospital set out to get these physicians out, that they manipulated data, that they created a biased report in order to achieve their aims and so on. Does Berman shield them from liability under those circumstances if that's true?
So, of course, we have arguments with respect to the truth of those allegations. The analysis in Berman and Desai, as the court is aware, is straightforward, and I'll just describe it this way. If the decisions are rationally related to the delivery of healthcare, the decisions are to be upheld. If the notion, and your question, I think, is asking, if there were some other motivations out there, whether they were motivations that are pointed to here with respect to transfer of patients, with respect to use of equipment at other hospitals instead of use of the equipment of value, which would promote collaboration, familiarity, and economic efficiency. Those are the motives. Those are the bad motives that plaintiffs say we had. But those aren't bad motives. Those are proper motivations on the part of a hospital that is trying to develop and grow a practice and have a practice that is going to benefit patients. That was why these arrangements, these kinds of arrangements, co-management arrangements, were studied all the way back to 2011 and before at the hospital, leading ultimately to the exclusive arrangement that was entered into with the Columbia Group. And so I'm not sure if I answered your question, but the motivations, what the other motivations, let's assume hypothetically that someone on the staff didn't care for Dr. Roth or another one of the plaintiffs. That is not enough to override the determination that would be made pursuant to Berman and Desai if the decision was rationally related to the delivery of healthcare. Otherwise, we'd be down that foxhole in every one of these cases. They didn't like me. They, you know, said this about me. We didn't get along as well as they would have liked us to. All kinds of claims about motivations could be made so long as there is a decision that's rationally related to the delivery of healthcare and it comports with Desai and Berman. That's the end of the inquiry.
Just following up on the chief's question, let's leave aside, as I understand that what plaintiff claims was bad faith was the white paper was a pretext. It was did not honestly apply the data. The goal was to have the white paper support the position of the hospital, and it did in a manner that the suggestion is was involved manipulation of data. Obviously, only the allegations of the plaintiffs. Secondly, there was a perception on the part of Valley that plaintiffs were loyal to Hackensack and not Valley, in essence. Let's leave aside the personal disagreements, the hospital doesn't like somebody, and leave aside for the moment that concept of these people were viewed by Valley management as not loyal to Valley, and focus on the allegation of manipulation of data. And I get the impact of the privilege issue on that, but leave that aside. If, in fact, that were to occur, if a hospital were to set out to assemble a data set that was was manipulated and wrong in order to prove a point with respect to a particular set of doctors. Doesn't that go thoroughly beyond Berman and Desai, which didn't involve any allegation of bad faith like that?
So, Justice, we know, at least in this case, and I'm going to get to the hypothetical in 1 second, we know at least in this case that was not what the trial court believed or found. Based on the summary judgment findings that clearly stated that the hospital undertook a rational and routine course of action to further Valley's longstanding alignment strategy, but there's nothing in the record to support the notion either Board or Myers made the decisions based on regarding exclusivity in an unreasonable manner. We know from the trial court's findings that
at summary judgment.
At summary judgment.
But the trial court let that part of the case go to the jury, and we don't know what the jury determined. But I understand you're making a very strong argument that none of that happened. But if that happened, or if an allegation was a jury concluded that allegation was correct, wouldn't that take this case at a significant distance from Berman?
So I think, you know, when we talk about motivations and we talk about whether the white paper was undertaken in bad faith, what we're not talking about are the kinds of causes of action that could be pled independently. And in some of the cases that are cited from other jurisdictions have been pled independently. This is not, you know, a violation. There's no claim of a violation of civil rights. There's no claim of law against discrimination. There's no claim of fraud in this case. What there was a suggestion that certain of the data was, you know, based on the cross-examination, whatever, not tailored fairly. What I would say about that is a couple of things. In this case, the white paper was based on information that already existed. There was already a long history of studying this notion of doing a co-management arrangement. Valley Hospital entered into exclusive arrangements many times in other areas of expertise. We know that the plaintiffs self-selected out of this arrangement. They did not want a co-management arrangement and obviously didn't want an exclusivity arrangement. We know that these exclusive arrangements are favored in the law, and we cite all the cases, not just from New Jersey, but from around the country, about why these exclusivity arrangements make sense and are appropriate. And so, you know, notions, you know, that were presented about this was really driven by, you know, quote unquote loyalty. Our response to that is there were serious concerns about, and we know what the numbers are, numbers that are not disputed.
But again, leaving that aside, because that is significantly more subjective than I would suggest than the allegation of manipulation of data. And I'm not commenting on whether that allegation was unfounded or founded or whatever. But if, in fact, we're talking about, you know, you began your argument by saying that there is broad discretion, it's essential for healthcare, citing Berman and Desai as providing the framework of the type of managerial decisions that have to be made on a daily basis by hospitals in order to deliver patient care. Those cases, correct me if I'm wrong, did not involve any allegation that there was a misuse or manipulation of data. And what I'm asking you is, and tell me if I'm wrong about that, what I'm asking you is whether you are truly within the parameters of Berman and Desai in light of this additional allegation that, for reasons you've outlined, found its way to the jury in this case.
And again, just to say it, there is not really allegations about manipulation of data. The numbers here, again, there was evidence presented at trial with respect to various things that were happening at the hospital and who was doing what and the rest. And it was cross-examination with respect to those items, much of which dealt with the privileged emails that had inadvertently disclosed. But to answer your question directly, these kinds of credibility questions that were raised with respect to the white paper and how it was prepared, do not override a determination that is made based on, normal course of business, which this was, as set forth in DeSign Berman, adequate info that's reasonable, as set forth in DeSign Berman, with a legitimate healthcare objective. The claims here didn't rise to standalone causes of action for, as I said before, under any of the statutes that I mentioned, or for fraud. They were challenges to the way the white paper was prepared. To me, much more like the suggestion that the motives were impure, and we know, and we would suggest that based on, for example, the Tenet healthcare case out of Texas, his motivations is not something that ought to be considered.
I'm sorry. No. I want to follow up. Let's put the words good faith to one side. Can a decision be deemed to reasonably and rationally advance the public's interest in healthcare if it is based on manipulated data? In another case,
if there are allegations that would rise to the level of, fraud, for example, that would be a separate claim that could be pled and could be argued. I don't know that. There isn't a set of circumstances that I could imagine where there wouldn't be a separate claim for fraud or for a violation of civil rights. Those claims have been made in other cases around the country at times. But in this case, at least, there was not any manipulation of data. And there was instead a rational and routine approach taken to enter into an exclusivity agreement. Again, there really wasn't a question about with whom, because the only real candidate was the Columbia Group. The real question was, and the reason why the white paper was done in the first place, was to make sure and to confirm that entering into this exclusive arrangement was not going to create any unintended or unanticipated negative consequences.
How do we know the alleged Berman violation, they call it a pretext, was subsumed in the jury's award of damages? In other words, the damage award was premised on the breach of implied covenant claim. There was no separate question to the jury about whether the exclusivity agreement somehow was reasonably and rationally related to a hospital healthcare rational decision.
If your question is your question, was the jury aware of the Berman and Desai construct?
Yes.
Yeah. I based on the charge, it doesn't look like they were.
But did you object to the jury charge?
So there were a number of a long colloquy, obviously, in respect to the charging conference. There were certain objections as it relates to Berman and Desai. There was, ironically, an argument by the plaintiffs that there should be a charge on Berman and Desai. But that was in the context, as I understand it, of their counts one and two of the complaint, which was discretionary determinations in the healthcare context and fundamental fairness. Those claims had been dismissed on the involuntary dismissal motion. So that was the colloquy at the charging conference on that issue. I think our position was the charge should not be included because those claims are not part of the case anymore.
I'm looking specifically at the jury charge on the implied covenant claim. And I'm just going to read part to you. It says, the plaintiff in this case claims that the defendant Valley breached the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing by encouraging plaintiffs to join Valley and take over the emergency department call schedule and invest time, resources, and effort to modernize the practice of neurosurgery at Valley, but then unfairly and dishonestly barring plaintiffs from using the tools and facilities they developed. And then it goes on, plaintiffs further contend that Valley breached the covenant of good faith and fair dealing by making a predetermined decision to exclude plaintiffs, creating a sham study by changing metrics to achieve its intended goal of skewing the results to show poor quality and negotiating a contract with, and then it's the Columbia Group before the study even began. Did you object to that charge?
There was not an objection by counsel to that charge specifically. Again,
found your client guilty of that whole scheme as it was laid out in the jury charge. And there seemed to be a number of separate parts of it. And there was no objection to that portion of the charge. Would that be invited error? How would we look at that?
Well, the motion for summary judgment had been made, and the issues as it relates to the contract issues had been preserved. And of course, our position is, as you've read in our papers and as I've said today, is that that's when the case should have ended and those contract claims should have been dismissed. With respect to the determination made on the breach of covenant of good faith and the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, our position is that claim now is alleged to be something that isn't included within the bylaws, that it's something beyond the bylaws. As I said before, that claim wasn't pled, but let's assume for purposes of argument that it existed, and that's what the jury made its determination on. It can't be that there was a determination made that the plaintiffs had forever privileges, which is the agreement they say was reached that was beyond the bylaws. If that was what they were deprived of, that's a direct breach of contract and can't be a breach of the implied covenant in good faith and fair dealing under Wade versus Kessler.
But the trial court, when it granted summary judgment, specifically did not decide summary judgment as to Valley Hospital. That's what went to trial. And at trial, the trial court, and there was, I believe, at the charge conference, but there was some discussion about the existence of a contract, and the jury was in fact charged on contract and that other outside agreement, implied contract. And if they find contract or implied contract, then they could also find a breach of the covenant. And wasn't that what the jury was asked to decide and decided against your client?
The notion that there was something other than the bylaws, as I understand it, is basically one thing. And that is, we have privileges, we the plaintiffs have privileges forever, unless, you know, it's ours to lose. And that in some way, shape or form created an agreement or a contract, express, implied, oral.
I didn't think that was it at all. I thought it was, and I believe Justice Patterson raised it, that they were induced to join the hospital staff to invest time and resources to develop the practice to make it the preeminent hospital in this neurosurgical, neurological area, and that they did all that. In other words, there was they were induced, they expended resources, they performed, and now they're there doing all this, and that implied contract was stripped out from under them. That's separate and apart from the bylaws or this contract that you're describing. That's an implied contract.
But the implied contract or oral contract, if we can use the term implied, the agreement, the implied agreement was that they would have these privileges forever. Again, giving them the benefit of every doubt because they did all of these purportedly wonderful things that doctors on staff would ordinarily do. But giving them the benefit of every doubt because they did all these wonderful things, there was this contract implied, however we want to define it. The what they were seeking relief from was the fact that their privileges that existed prior to this litigation being filed should have continued forever. It was theirs to lose. That's the only.
In an implied contract, it's not that it will go on forever. It will go on until it is properly and appropriately terminated in good faith.
I'll accept that.
And your argument is it wasn't terminated in good faith here. The white paper's a sham. The numbers were fudged. We should still be there.
But Justice, that is a breach of contract. That is not an implied covenant claim. That is a breach of contract, implied contract, oral contract, or whatever. It's not a good faith and fair dealing claim.
I understand, but it was charged to the jury, and I think correctly by the trial judge, that every contract, expressed, written, or implied, carries with it a covenant of good faith and fair deal. So you can't separate the two. They're part of the same thing. That covenant, that promise to act in good faith and fairly, is part of the implied contract or the actual contract in this case. I think.
Let me try and say it this way. The covenant of good faith and fair dealing cause of action cannot be that the contract was breached, whether the contract was implied or otherwise. The good faith and fair dealing cause of action under Wade versus Kessler cannot be a breach of contract. It has to be, you know, steps taken to frustrate the objectives under the contract. It cannot be that the that the contract that was reached was breached. But the only position that's been taken throughout this case was that the hospital breached this purported implied or oral contract, aside from the bylaws, which is what was pled and which is the case was litigated on. But in the hypothetical that we're talking about now, this only the only agreement, implied or otherwise, was with respect to having privileges for longer than they had them. Those privileges were limited sooner before they would have liked. That is a breach of contract claim, not a covenant of good faith and fair dealing claim.
So are you saying even though as a legal principle there is a covenant of good faith and fair dealing that attaches to every contract, the only breach of the covenant of fair dealing, of good faith and fair dealing, that was alleged in this case relates to the bylaws and not to this other?
That's all that was alleged. That's all that was pled.
You're saying the plaintiffs did not choose to assert a breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing claim with respect to this second implied contract?
What I'm saying is, if they could have alleged that there was an implied contract or an oral contract that entitled them to forever privileges, they didn't allege that, but they could have. Had they alleged that, they could have alleged breach of contract, and they could have alleged breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing. My point is, under Wade versus Kessler, if your claim is that you were denied these forever privileges, and those forever privileges are denied, that's a breach of contract. It's not a breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. And ultimately, when we try and cut through all of the morass, which the court is doing an excellent job of, the breach of contract claim is gone in this case. The jury no-caused it. All that was left was the implied covenant claim.
So if obviously there's case law where there is no breach of contract, but there's a breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing.
Yeah.
And is it so? Just so I understand your argument. Your argument is as to leaving aside the bylaws for the moment, as to this implied contract based upon building up the practice and bringing in patients and doing the things that they say they were asked to do and did do. The fact that the allegation here is that they lost privileges means that what they were really alleging is a breach of contract claim, not a breach of the covenant.
Correct. And if we look at, you know, any of the implied covenant cases, we know that those cases are based on conduct which doesn't necessarily breach the purported contract.
But there can be some of these cases can be, there's a murky gray area where the same conduct can both cause the purposes of the conduct of the contract to be frustrated, but also breach the contract. Am I wrong about that?
I think Wade versus Kessler is clear on this point. You've got the breach of contract when the object of the contract is breached this year, the quote unquote forever privileges, those forever privileges are diminished. That's the breach of contract. It's not, you know, like under Brunswick Hills, I guess, where, you know, we're talking about, you know, messing around with someone's option and trying to trick them into not exercising it. That's a breach of the covenant, implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. There wasn't that the Brunswick case was not decided on the contractor's breach. They didn't actually breach the contract. The allegations were, and what the case was about, was the conduct around it effectively, you know, through misleading statements and the rest, frustrated the plaintiff's opportunity in that case to exercise the option.
And so the charge that Justice Wainwright read earlier, the paragraph that's at DA 82, how was that prepared?
How was it prepared?
Yeah. Did the judge craft it? Did the parties present it together? Did one side present it? How did it start?
So I have to admit that I, having not tried the matter myself, I'm not sure how it exactly came to being, Justice. I wasn't there. The language ended up in the in the charge. There was discussion and debate around it, and as I acknowledged before, there was not an objection with respect to that language.
Perhaps Mr. Vernera can help us on that. Please, would you? It's now 12:30. Would you like to address the emails?
I'm so sorry. I had one more question.
Oh, please, sorry.
Point on the implied covenant claim. That a breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing is generally something that does not breach the contract, but that frustrates the other party's ability to perform under the contract or something similar to that. Whereas here, the allegation is not that something that the hospital did frustrated the doctor's ability to perform under the contract. And instead, it is that the hospital breached a commitment to allow the doctors to have ER call and use the bioplane and the gamma knife forever. And that is only a breach of contract, not anything that frustrated the doctor's ability to fulfill their end of the bargain.
Thank Justice, you said it better than I did. And I would just add to that.
You said a lot better than I did.
I would just add that, well, I'm not even going to try and add to it. Otherwise, well done. Thank you.
Emails.
Take it?
Emails.
Emails. So let me just spend a moment talking about one of the many emails that we have argued were utilized improperly in this case. In your deliberations, I would urge you to spend just a couple of minutes to take a look at DA 295 and DA 296. It's just a relatively short email string that starts with a note from Gail Calandrillo, who is Vice President at Valley, a client, for lack of a better term, not a lawyer, to Robin Goldfisher, and then a response from Gail, and there are other people copied on the email, including the director of operations and the hospital's president, Audrey Myers. But this is an attorney-client communication. And what you'll see, and it's not totally obvious from the face of the email unless you understand the who's who and what's what, but Ms. Calandrillo is asking the general counsel, Robin Goldfisher, for advice with respect to the very issue that we're here to talk about today. And apparently you can tell from the face of the email that Ms. Goldfisher had sent to Ms. Calandrillo, attorney to client, advice from outside counsel. And they're mentioned here, Andy McBride and Linda Haddad. And the email says, Robin, thanks for sending all the materials from Andy McBride and Linda Haddad on this topic. And then she proceeds to ask a number of questions about what they should do and how they should approach things. And Ms. Goldfisher does, as I said in my opening, what every lawyer who's dealing with potential litigation would do. She provides advice about how to deal with it. And she says in a totally routine way, frankly, in my estimation, but you'll make your own judgment, that the issues will need to be studied, that things are going to need to be documented, that we're going to need to meet and talk about it. And I will just say that when I read this email for the first time, it struck me that this is what I do and so many of our colleagues do every day. Clients come into our offices on issues involving all kinds of matters with concerns about potential litigation. And I can't count the number of times that I have said to the client sitting in my conference room, and this is absolutely no different. I understand the concern. I understand what you want to do. We need to do a little work first. We need to do some investigation. We need to do a little studying. We need to do a written report so we're prepared, whatever. The bottom line is that's what happened here. And if the finding of the appellate division is allowed to stand, we have to change the way we practice law.
Except that currently 503C2 now has a clawback. Currently, the rule's been changed.
Correct. And there was a protective order in this case that squarely provided for clawback and non-waiver. The protective order provided, you know, it's 100% on point with what you would want to see in order to protect against this kind of an event where these privileged emails are inadvertently turned over, and then they are used to spin these conspiracy theories.
Is this email perhaps different than the ordinary one that you described in that it puts quotation marks around the word study?
Look, the explanation on this was clear in the sense that the staff development folks who are referenced here are not the ones who do the study. But regardless, if my communication to my client about going to go out and get a report to, you know, substantiate X, Y, or Z is an issue when that report is prepared, the law on issue waiver is changed completely. And I've got to change the way I communicate, and I think many of our colleagues would have to change the way we communicate. There's nothing, and you'll read the emails in context here, there's nothing surprising about it at all, except that it's a private attorney-client communication that is now being used to cross-examine the general counsel of Valley and make, you know, to create the impression that there was some grand conspiracy when all she was doing was providing advice in anticipation of litigation.
Anything else you'd like to add?
I think we've covered the landscape, Your Honor, and I will save the rest of my time for
a follow-up on that.
Justice
Carino, is that protective order that you mentioned with a clawback provision in the record?
I believe it is.
I can look it up if you want to.
Let me just tell you. It's
also tell us after the lunch break if you don't have it handy.
I actually happen to have it. DA 322. And the relevant provisions are on DA 329, paragraph 12, and continuing on to page 330, talks about the things you would expect to see in a clawback, in a protective order that has a clawback provision.
We're going to move on to the next advocate.
Oh, I'm sorry. Could you elaborate very briefly on what you meant by remand? You said remand in your opening remarks.
So our initial position is that the case should have been, contract claim should have been dismissed on summary judgment, and that would end the case. I think there were some cross appeals, but I think that effectively ends the case. If the court finds that the attorney-client privilege was not waived here, or if the court finds that the commentary during summation was reversible error, then I think we're in remand territory.
Thank you.